One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today. And get your old self back naturally.
I'm Kathy with a C.
And I'm Kathy with a K.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is Boston, Massachusetts. Boston is the capital of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and is currently the cultural and financial center of the New England area. The city is now almost 700,000 residents and was founded in 1630 by English Puritan settlers and named after a market town in England. It is impossible to highlight the historical significance of Boston in our country's history. The city's harbor was the site of the Boston Tea Party tax revolt and hence the birthplace of the American Revolution. Bostonians have always been independent-minded, evidenced by causes they championed, such as the abolition of slavery and voting rights for women. Boston is also the home of notable patriots who played a key role in our young country's development, including Paul Revere, Samuel Adams, a man whose beer I love, and John Hancock. Over the centuries, Boston has grown to become a global leader in higher education and research, the home of the largest biotechnology hub in the world, and the birthplace of Dunkin' Donuts. History runs deep through the veins of this city, and for many decades, so did racial tensions. And in 1989, fuel was thrown onto this fire when one young white couple was attacked in the Mission Hill neighborhood.
It was 8:43 p.m. on October 23, 1989, when the 911 call came into the Boston State Police. Charles Stewart, who went by Chuck, was struggling to talk. He told the dispatcher, "My wife's been shot. I've been shot." But when Chuck was asked where they were, he said they'd left Brigham and Women's Hospital only a few minutes before, but had no idea where he was. The police dispatcher tried to get Chuck to give him some idea of where he might be, but Chuck was fading in and out of consciousness. The dispatcher asked if Chuck could see any street signs, and a distressed Chuck replied that he didn't see any. The dispatcher continued to try and coax information out of Chuck in order to send medical personnel to help him and his wife Carol, even encouraging Chuck to drive a little further up the street if he could do it without hurting himself or others. Chuck drove a short distance and said he was coming up on an intersection, but he still couldn't see any street signs. According to an article in the Boston Globe on October 25, 1989, journalist Anthony Flint reported that for the next several minutes, the dispatcher urged Chuck to give any clue about his location and to keep from passing out. He said, "Hang on, Chuck. Come on, man. I need you." But soon the only sound on the 911 call was Chuck's muffled breathing. The dispatcher repeatedly said, "Chuck, Chuck, pick up the phone. Pick up the phone." And then at one point, after getting no response, the dispatcher was heard on the call muttering, "Damn." And Kath, this is when the dispatcher came up with an idea. Although it was very rare in 1989, Chuck was actually calling police from a car telephone. And what's strange is, and you know, nobody had car phones back in 1989. Maybe like a dozen people.
Yeah, my uncle actually had one.
Well, see, there's a part of the dozen.
It was like 11 inches by 9 inches. It was huge.
Okay, and so just 2 years earlier, the Massachusetts State Police had actually opened a phone line specifically for car telephone owners in an emergency. But since it was the Massachusetts State Police who answered the car phone calls, the dispatcher didn't know where exactly in the state the Stewarts were.
Chuck had mentioned that he and his wife had just left the Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is one of the largest teaching hospitals for Harvard University. They were there for a childbirthing class because Carol was 7 months pregnant. The dispatcher was able to confirm that the Stewarts were still in Boston, and prior to Chuck losing consciousness, he told the dispatcher he was driving a blue Toyota Cressida. And since the phone line was still open when Chuck passed out, the Massachusetts State Police dispatcher reached out to the Boston police for help locating the car. And Kath, I thought this was genius. He told the police officers to fan out in the area and turn on their sirens. And so the police cars took turns turning on their sirens, and the police dispatcher basically said, "I hear it. I hear a siren. That officer is close." I
mean, isn't that amazing?
It's so smart.
I hope he got awards for that.
I know, seriously. So within 10 minutes of the original call, Boston police found the Stewarts' blue Toyota in the Mission Hill neighborhood of Boston. Mission Hill was a predominantly black area and was home to a notorious housing project. Chuck and Carol Stewart were both suffering from gunshot wounds and rushed to the hospital. Carol was taken back to Brigham and Women's Hospital. Sometime before midnight on Monday, October 23rd, 1989, doctors delivered a baby boy born 8 weeks premature, and he was baptized in the delivery room. Baby boy Christopher weighed only 3 pounds and 13 ounces and was immediately rushed to the neonatal intensive care unit. An unconscious Chuck was taken to Boston City Hospital to undergo emergency surgery for a gunshot wound to his abdomen. Tragically, Carol died several hours later at 3 a.m. from the point-blank gunshot wound to the back of her head.
By all accounts, after 4 years of marriage, Chuck and Carol Stewart were known by their family and close friends as a great couple. One woman who said she and her husband were the Stewarts' closest friends said that they were the best type of people and would do anything for you. They had a huge number of friends, and they were loved by everyone who knew them. 30-year-old Carol was born and raised in Medford, which was a northern suburb of Boston, and graduated from Boston College in 1981. She went on to graduate summa cum laude from Suffolk Law School 4 years later. 30-year-old Chuck, who grew up fewer than 10 miles from Boston in Revere, attended Brown University on a football scholarship, but transferred to Salem State College after he suffered a knee injury. The couple met when they both worked at a seafood restaurant called The Driftwood during college. Carol was a waitress and Chuck was a cook. The couple married in 1985 and moved into a small house in Medford. People close to the couple said that they had postponed having a family in order to save some money and pursue their careers. Kath, at the time of her death, Carol was a lawyer specializing in tax matters, which being a lawyer is hard enough, let alone knowing tax law.
No, that's super studly.
And she did this for a publishing company. Chuck worked as the general manager at a fur shop.
Okay, quick side note. My grandmother had beautiful mink stoles, and my sister still wears one of them. And she was on the metro in DC one day, and someone got on her high horse because my sister was wearing a real fur. "How many had to die for you to wear that fur?" And my sister goes, "One, just my grandma."
Your sister's funny.
Oh my God. Anyway, so.
Both of your sisters are funny, but that's awesome.
Yeah.
Chuck and Carol were very active. She was a runner and a member of her company softball team, while Chuck was a member of several sports teams, including a hockey league and basketball team. So, Kath, in addition to being a studly tax lawyer, Carol was also attending classes at Boston University in hopes of becoming a CPA. Chuck and Carol were also close with their families. Chuck was the eldest of 3 brothers and 2 sisters, and Carol had 1 brother, Carl, with whom she was close. Together, they often hosted family gatherings during the summer poolside at the suburban Reading home they had just purchased 2 years earlier. So, the primary news source for this episode was a written account in the Boston Globe based on the Murder in Boston podcast created by the Globe and reported by their journalists Adrian Walker, Evan Allen, Elizabeth Coe, Andrew Ryan, Kristen Nelson, and Brendan McCarthy. The story was published December 1st, 2023. And Kath, I loved this reporting. It was fantastic and it was in-depth.
It was reported that as Chuck was being loaded into the ambulance after his 911 call, he was asked if he knew who shot him. His response was just two words, black man. Mayor Raymond Flynn and Police Commissioner Francis Roach issued a statement later that night. They had met with the victims' families at the hospital, and the mayor, dressed in a sweatsuit given the late hour, was angry. He said, "I demand that the Boston Police Department continue to be extremely aggressive and cracking down on people who are using guns and killing innocent people. It's intolerable. We will use every lawful tool to support our police officers in cracking down on gun-wielding criminals." Now, assigned to the case were two of the Boston Police Department's best detectives, Robert Ahern and Robert Tinlin, both of who went by Bob.
They're just like us. They should do a podcast, although you can't spell
it. It's Bob
it.
And Bob.
But you can't spell one of the Bobs differently. So no, how are you going to tell them apart?
I don't know. And the two had solved almost every case they worked on. They were both former Navy and were nicknamed the Two Bobbies, except by friends who probably called them the Two Boobies.
Totally.
Especially cops. According to the podcast, Ahern was ruddy-faced with a salt and pepper mustache, a raucous sense of humor, and Jordache jeans.
I wonder if by raucous they mean gallows.
Oh, I'm sure. He was probably a totally like...
He was old school.
Yeah, exactly. Except for the Jordache. But probably nobody made fun of his jeans because he would have kicked their ass. Tinlin was quieter, the bad cop to Ahern's good. In their office, they had an autographed poster of TV detective Columbo.
And Kath, when I saw that, I totally thought of you. I know you love Columbo.
I totally did. 2 days after the shooting, another Boston Globe article by Anthony Flint reported that at the scene, Chuck Stewart told police when the gunman ran up to the blue Cressida, he said, "I think you're 5-0," which was slang for police. Investigators speculated that it was likely because the car had an antenna on the roof at the time when personal vehicles rarely had them. This, of course, was for the car phone. And it was when the killer saw the phone in the car that he shot the couple. At this point, however, police were unable to talk to Chuck because he was in critical condition after surgery for the gunshot wound to his abdomen. Detectives were convinced that the gunman either lived in or routinely committed crimes around the Mission Hill housing project where the shooting occurred. Because of the location, investigators set their sights on residents and visitors to the area, questioning people they had locked up before, as well as the neighborhood toughs who knew about most of the crime that went on in the neighborhood.
When I saw that in the podcast transcript, I totally had to include that because I loved that they called them toughs.
Toughs, exactly. One of the investigators told the reporter that they were confident that someone in Mission Hill was going to give up the guy, either to do the right thing or to get the heat of the police out of the neighborhood.
2 days after Carol was killed, one of Chuck's three brothers, Michael, who was a firefighter for the city of Revere, told the press that Chuck had been told about Carol's murder and the birth of his son the day before. They also told him that baby Christopher was sick and in the NICU. Doctors and family members knew Christopher's own chances of survival weren't good because he'd been without oxygen for about 30 minutes between the time his mother was shot and medical help arrived. And detectives would have to wait another 3 days before they could talk to Chuck. After surgery, he remained in critical condition and was too heavily medicated to talk. Kath, this bullet did serious damage. It went through his liver and intestines, and it missed his aorta by the smallest fraction of an inch. As a result, of course, doctors had warned the detectives that they had to keep their visit brief, so they stuck to the basics. What happened and who did it? Chuck was able to give a bit more of a description than he had right after the shooting. He said the shooter was 28 to 34 years old, 5'10", gaunt, with high cheekbones, a short afro, and a raspy voice with a sing-song tone. When the killer ran up to the car and got in the back seat, he ordered Chuck not to look in the rearview mirror and demanded money. The killer then called Chuck 5-0 and started shooting. And since Chuck was still on a lot of pain medication, he got tired quickly, so the visit was short.
Carol DeMady Stewart's funeral mass was held at St. James Catholic Church in Medford just 5 days after the shooting. The priest who presided over the mass was the same one who had married her and Chuck just 4 years earlier. More than 800 people attended the funeral, and inside the church, it was standing room only. Among the notable names was Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis and Boston's mayor, as well as the police commissioner. but Chuck Stewart wasn't able to attend the funeral because he was still recuperating from surgery. And Kath, this was not odd. She was buried 5 days after her death, and it was very common at this time to have a funeral within a week of the person's death. We're used to now people being cremated and maybe a couple months later having a celebration of life. That's not how funerals operated ever until very recently. But even though Chuck couldn't attend, he wrote a letter to his wife and had his best friend read it in his place. The letter began by saying, "Good night, sweet wife, my love. God has called you to his hands. He also called on those in attendance to forgive Carol's killer." He concluded by saying, "Now you sleep away from me. I will never again know the feeling of your hand in mine, but I will always feel you. I miss you and I love you. Your husband, Chuck." Just 10 days later, Chuck and Carol's baby boy died. Christopher William Stewart was 17 days old when he took his last breath. He was then buried next to his mom. The same day as the funeral, after 5 days of searching for the man who murdered Carol Stewart and her baby boy, police received a tip that they thought would blow the case wide open. The word on the street was that the shooter was a guy named Albie. Apparently, Albie's name had been circulating among Mission Hill drug users, and finally, someone had flagged down an officer to pass it along. And Kath, the police were all over this neighborhood. And so this tip did not come as a surprise because there was so much heat. Albie was known as a robber around Mission Hill. He had a gun and a drug problem, and ever since the shooting, he'd been acting really nervous, talking about making a plan to get out of the city because things were too hot. He was holed up in a vacant apartment not far from where the Stewarts were found, getting mad anytime anybody brought up the manhunt. And perhaps most importantly, Albie was a black male, 5'10", 160 pounds, with a thin build and shaggy facial hair. And as I said a minute ago, it was well known that he carried a gun. 2 days later, the Boston Globe ran a story about Albie's arrest. It appeared alongside a front page article about the rising tide of support for bringing back the death penalty in the wake of the Stewart slaying. Now, he wasn't picked up for murder. They picked him up for breaking into an apartment, but it gave the police time to build a case against him. Detectives were hoping that the evidence found at the scene of the shooting would provide a possible physical link between Albie and the Stewarts. Police had announced a few days prior that several partial fingerprints were obtained from the Stewarts' car where the shooting took place. Albie was on a list of several suspects developed by the police, but he was the first one of those to be taken into custody.
One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
But soon, reports began to leak out that police weren't 100% sure whether Albie Swanson really fit the description of their prime suspect. They believed that it was likely he was just the small-time thug that they'd always known him to be. Just a few days later, so about a week after Carol Stewart was killed, the Bobbies were beginning to think that Chuck Stewart might have been behind the murder. When they had interviewed him, he reminded them of another case they worked. A white guy by the name of John Jenks, who shot a black man, then shot himself to make it look like he was the victim. They had also interviewed Jenks in the hospital bed, and just like Chuck, he had seemed too calm. But of course, there was one big difference. Jenks had suffered a superficial wound, but Chuck had very nearly died. And Kath, his surgeon, who happened to be the hospital's chief of trauma and had seen thousands of bullet wounds as a surgeon in Vietnam, said it was impossible that Chuck had shot himself. The location of the entry wound, which was in Chuck's lower back, had an upward angle of the bullet's path. If he had shot himself, it would have had a downward angle. And there was one bullet hole in the driver's seat that had been fired from the back seat that went straight into Chuck's back. At about 8:45 p.m. on Monday, October 30th, this is the same day and time as the shooting just 1 week later, the Bobbies borrowed a car with the tape deck. And if you don't know what that is, ask your parents.
You got to know what that is. We'll be ashamed of you if you don't.
Exactly. And they put a recording of Chuck's 911 call in as they drove. First, they drove from Brigham and Women's Hospital all the way to the spot where Chuck said the black man jumped into their car. Once the detectives were in place, they hit play on the tape and followed the route as Chuck described it to the 911 dispatcher on the night of the murder. Now, as they followed the route, everything Chuck said to the dispatcher rang true. They passed the same landmarks that he'd mentioned, which Kath included a half-demolished bar where there was a yellow Schlitz sign still in the window.
Is that malt liquor?
I think it
is. I think it's malt liquor.
You know, I don't know if I've told this story, but the very first time I drank was with the person who I'm sitting in the closet with. And we went to the liquor store by your house and you bought, do you
Old
remember this?
English 800. Oh,
it was malt liquor.
Oh my God, I totally did.
Not good. I appreciate all that Kathy has done to school me on the ways of the world.
Not done for her, but done to her.
Potato, potato. Now, where the Schlitz sign was actually where the shooting happened. So the Bobbies then took the same route back and wound up heading towards the hospital. So it was exactly the same as Chuck had described. He'd been telling the truth about all of that. But as the Bobbies sat in the area where the shooting occurred, they realized there was one major difference between what they were seeing and what Chuck told the dispatcher. He'd said there was no one on the street to ask for help and couldn't see a street sign to guide first responders. But as detectives drove around that location on the same night of the week at the same time, the streets were bustling with people, so Chuck should have been able to find help. And to the Bobbies, all of the streets had very noticeable and readable signs where Chuck said he hadn't been able to read them. Just a week or so later, the Bobbies told the head of the homicide unit that they thought Chuck was the killer. The head of the unit told them to keep looking into it, but also let them know that the unit was also looking in other directions. Not long afterwards, the Bobbies happened to take a few days off, and when they came back to work, the Stewart murder files had been taken out of their office. It wasn't their case anymore. The Stewart case had been given to a new set of detectives, and they had a new suspect. He was a notorious figure in Mission Hill, a dangerous man who had started two separate shootouts with police and didn't care if he lived or died, so long as he went down shooting. He was erratic and drugged out and capable of anything. His name was Willie Bennett, and he was arrested at the end of December 1989, almost 2 months after Carol Stewart was killed. Chuck was asked to go down to police headquarters just a few days after that, so on December 28, 1989, he viewed a lineup of possible suspects. He picked suspect number 3 out of the row of 8 black men in the lineup. It was Willie Bennett. Chuck told police he recognized Willie's jawline and the shape of his ear and was 99% sure that number 3 was the shooter. But like Albie Swanson, prosecutors didn't charge Willie with murder, instead charging him with a lesser offense unrelated to Carol's murder. But then the newspapers and TV stations began reporting that Chuck's identification of Willie had been shaky. However, the sources used for the arrest of both Willie and Albie were all anonymous, and officials refused to comment.
But just after the new year, almost 2.5 months after Carol was killed, Chuck Stewart's account of what happened the night his wife died had begun to unravel. Around 7 o'clock in the morning on January 4th, 1990, a businessman driving on a bridge that crossed the Mystic River saw a man climb over the railing and stand at the very edge of the bridge looking at the water. Rush hour was beginning to pick up, so there were more people driving by who saw the same thing. But no one stopped to help or called police to report the man standing on the edge of the bridge. By mid-morning, it was reported that a man had jumped off the bridge. State police divers were in the turbulent water being circled by police boats for safety. Helicopters also flew overhead, hoping to find the person who jumped. There were rumors at this point that it was Chuck Stewart, but police would not confirm that to the media. But what the public also didn't know was that overnight, Chuck's younger brother had come forward with new information about what happened to Carol and baby Christopher. As it turned out, the emergency phone at the Revere Fire Station where Chuck's brother Michael worked recorded a call between Chuck's siblings, Michael, and his sister Shelley. In one of the calls, Shelley was recorded as saying, "Michael, we're all meeting here right now." But it was probably more like, "Michael, I can't even do it. We're all meeting. I can't even do a Boston accent."
Oh, I thought you were trying to do a bossy sister accent.
I know.
You could totally do that.
I couldn't.
There's not enough R's for you to be able to do a Boston accent.
I know.
Has to end with an R. Makes it better. Makes it easier for us non-Bostonians to say.
Anyway, she said, "Michael, we're all meeting here right now." Michael told her he was working and he could only leave if it was an emergency. And Shelley said, "Talk to your boss because it is an emergency." So Michael started to waffle about whether or not he should leave. And she made up his mind when she said, "Say it's an emergency at home because it is. We're going to tell mom and dad." The journalists of the Murder in Boston podcast that Kathy previously referenced were able to untangle the web of lies. But at this point, Chuck Stewart was dead. It was, in fact, him who jumped from the bridge.
At this point in time, the number of people who knew the truth about what really happened the night Carol was killed tallied more than a dozen. Now remember, this is 2.5 months after Carol was killed. Every one of these people chose to keep that information secret. They kept it secret as the community, state, nation, and world mourned the loss of Carol and baby Christopher. They kept it a secret as the predominantly black neighborhood surrounding the Mission Hill housing project was consistently rousted by police. Certain one of them was the killer, or at least knew who he was. And they kept it a secret as two black men were arrested for a murder all of those people knew the men didn't commit. So on the evening of the recorded phone call, this is January 3rd, Chuck Stewart's siblings told their parents and the one sibling who didn't know about any of this the truth of what happened. After that, two of the brothers, Michael and Matthew, went to the Suffolk District Attorney's office and met with two Boston police detectives. Here's what 28-year-old Michael and 23-year-old Matthew told the detectives. At the beginning of August 1989, so almost 3 months before Carol was killed, Chuck showed up at his brother Michael's house and asked him to go for a ride. As they drove around in Chuck's van, he told Michael he was planning something. But according to Michael, as Chuck talked about his plan, he was being kind of cagey and talked in circles and didn't actually overtly ask Michael to do anything. But Michael told police that he knew that Chuck wanted his help in killing Carol. Michael told Chuck that whatever he wanted, the answer was no. Michael was finally making a good steady paycheck with the fire department and didn't want to take the risk. I think he also meant to say it was the wrong thing to do, but I'm just speculating. After Michael said no, Chuck didn't turn to his brother Matthew right away. The two of them hadn't spoken to one another for 18 months after having a fight. Now, Chuck was the oldest. There were about 7 years that separated the two of them. But just 1 month after Michael turned Chuck down for whatever it was he wanted, in September of 1989, Chuck broke the silence and reached out to ask for Matthew's help. Now, Kath, by the fall of 1989, both of their parents were gravely ill. Their mother was battling breast cancer and their father was suffering from Parkinson's. So Chuck told Matthew it was time to end their feud for the good of the family. But at the same time when Chuck reached out, he also told Matthew he had a plan that could make them both some money. And it was something that Matthew needed. Where Chuck was ruthlessly ambitious, Matthew was aimless. Where Chuck lived in a nice house in an upscale suburb, Matthew still lived in his parents' basement. And Matthew had to work odd jobs to pay for his alcohol addiction. Now, during their conversation, Chuck said that it was just an insurance job, and he promised to make it worth Matthew's while. The insurance job, which I don't think you all can see the air quotes I'm putting up, but I am, turned out to be a staged robbery of Chuck's home while Chuck and Carol were out of the house. The staged robbery took place in mid-October 1989, just about a week before Carol was killed. As planned, Matthew snuck into Chuck's empty house to take a bag of jewelry. Chuck had said he planned to report it stolen to his insurance company to collect a payout. But when Matthew crept into the basement at the agreed date and time, he discovered that the house was not empty and both Chuck and Carol were still home.
Ruh-roh.
Exactly.
Bad plan, Chuck.
Matthew wound up hiding in the basement bathroom until Chuck pretended a fuse had blown and went downstairs to tell Matthew to run. Now, while Matthew freaked out about this near miss of almost being discovered, Chuck told Matthew he had a new idea, something that was even easier and more lucrative. Sounds like one of those, just pay shipping and you'll get one more for a penny.
Right.
At the time, Chuck wouldn't tell his younger brother any details, but said he'd pay him up to $10,000 for taking part in what he had planned. So on October 22nd, the day before the murder, Matthew told detectives Chuck took him down to Boston. They drove past Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Chuck pointed to the parking garage where he said he was going to park. Chuck then drove to the Mission Hill neighborhood and drove around to a space and pulled over. Chuck told Matthew to be there the following night at about 8:20-ish and wait for Chuck to drive toward him where Chuck would throw Matthew a bag. And according to Matthew, that was all Chuck asked him to do.
On October 23rd, the night of the murder, Matthew got to the place in the Mission Hill neighborhood where Chuck told him to park, and then Matthew waited. Around 8:15, he told detectives that he saw Chuck's blue Toyota come speeding around the corner toward him. Matthew could see something bulky in the passenger seat, which he thought was just a pile of clothes. Chuck pulled up to Matthew's window and tossed him a purse and told him to get rid of it. Chuck then told him to get out of the area and cautioned him to drive slowly. Matthew maintained that he did not know what Chuck had done until he saw the shooting on the news. But Michael and Matthew weren't the only ones who knew about Chuck's evil plan. Around the same time Chuck talked to Michael, and this was the beginning of August, a couple months prior, Chuck had invited an old high school friend, David, out to dinner, and as they sat in a restaurant, Chuck asked David if he would help kill Carol too. Like Michael, David told Chuck, no. So Chuck's youngest brother, Matthew, told his ex-girlfriend, Janet, with whom he'd broken up a couple months prior, as well as his friend, Jack, that Chuck was looking for someone to kill Carol. Jack then told his girlfriend, his mom, his dad's girlfriend, and his brother's girlfriend. And then Janet told a bunch of her friends. But by the time of Carol's funeral, at least 11 people knew that Chuck wanted his wife dead, including two of the men who carried her casket. When Chuck got out of the hospital, Carol's family, who clearly weren't let in on his dirty little secret, offered to let him live with them while he recuperated. But he declined, saying he needed to be alone. Right around the new year, he moved back into the house with the pool where Carol had dreamed of raising her family. Turns out Chuck wanted to be alone because he now had a girlfriend.
So not alone alone, yeah. Just not
with anybody else around. That woman was a 22-year-old college student named Debbie, and she'd met 30-year-old Chuck at the fur shop where they both worked. When he was in the hospital after being shot, Debbie visited him and called him every day. Chuck had told at least one of his friends before the murder that they were sleeping together. While Chuck was laid up, Debbie kept a journal for him chronicling the things that he was missing. Good songs, full moons, rainstorms, astrological forecasts, and she told him she loved him.
Okay, what's the word for that?
I don't know.
Or the phrase for that?
These are like the musings of an overly romantic, under-realistic. It's like posts you see, like old classified ads, like sensitive fireman with a Labrador seeks a woman for a serious relationship who loves to walk on the beach. You know what I mean?
And follow rainbows.
Right, exactly.
And Hello Kitty.
Right. Exactly. So it speaks to her age.
Absolutely, it does.
According to the Boston Globe's in-depth coverage, the following account comes from hours of subsequent police interviews, sworn grand jury testimony, and court filings. Unbeknownst to many, a grand jury had been convened to look into the murders. Here are the details that slowly emerged about what really happened on the night Carol Stewart was killed. As a seemingly endless stream of Boston police cars converged on Mission Hill looking for Chuck's blue Toyota, a silver Toyota passed the police as it headed in the opposite direction. Behind the wheel of the silver Toyota was Chuck's younger brother, Matthew. Chuck had thrown his wife's purse to his brother Matthew, and Matthew drove with it on the passenger seat next to him. Inside was a silver-plated .38 caliber revolver, the same caliber of gun used in the shootings. Matthew then drove home to Revere. He went directly to the basement of his parents' house, which is where his bedroom was, and put Carol's purse with the gun inside a drawer. He went upstairs and found his mother, his sister, and his brothers crying in the kitchen. They then told Matthew that Chuck and Carol had been shot. They were about to leave to go to the hospital where Chuck was being treated, and they asked Matthew to stay behind with their father, who was too ill to go out. Once the family was gone, Matthew slipped out the back door, leaving his ailing father alone, and headed around the corner to the house of his childhood best friend, a man named Jack. Matthew and Jack walked down a deserted set of railroad tracks to a bridge over a flowing river. They put Carol's purse in a trash bag weighed down with bricks and threw it into the river. They also cut several small holes in the plastic bag so the air bubbles, you know, wouldn't cause it to come to the surface.
That's brilliant.
I know. Also thrown into the river was the gun.
Because Chuck killed himself, his culpability was never legally determined. But when Matthew Stewart confessed to Boston police that he disposed of the gun after Chuck killed Carol, he said he was motivated by the fear that his brother Chuck would go to the cops first and blame him for everything. In 1992, 2 years after Chuck Stewart killed himself, his brother Matthew pleaded guilty to conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and unlawful possession of a firearm, among other things, in exchange for 3 to 5 years in prison. His friend Jack, who helped him dispose of the evidence, pled guilty to similar charges and was given 1 to 3 years in prison. Matthew was released on probation in 1995, and in the ensuing years, he struggled with addiction to drugs and alcohol. In 2011, Matthew was found dead from an accidental overdose in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, although the official story of the Stewart murder case is that Chuck acted alone, many people speculated that Matthew was actually the one to pull the trigger. In the aftermath of their daughter's murder, Carol's parents, Evelyn and Justo, and her brother Carl, created a foundation that would serve as a positive legacy in her memory. The foundation was set up to provide scholarship money specifically to benefit young people from Mission Hill who were so wrongly targeted after Carol and baby Christopher's murders. So quickly as we conclude, I just wanted to give another shout out to the Boston Globe Murder in Boston podcast and all the reporters who did this. We painted only a light picture of this crime. There was so much going on in Boston at the time. There was political corruption at the local and state levels. There were racial tensions. It was awful. The Mission Hill neighborhood, the housing project where this happened, were relentlessly pounded by police. The Murder in Boston podcast paints such a large picture of all of this. And so if you're interested in listening to something that gives a really in-depth social picture, then we highly suggest that you go listen to the Murder in Boston podcast.
Thanks so much for listening.
We appreciate you.
Bye.
Check engine light on. Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today. Oh, oh.